Good evening. We are in Job 28. It's a beautiful poem, and we are going to try to cover the content of it this evening. And after that, we would only have the conclusion in chapter 42. And I have a little secret to tell you. Now, I look at myself. That's not the secret I was going to tell you. I look at myself on Sunday evening, that light, with my hoary head, you know. It is pretty strange. I'm almost tempted to put the hat. Can I push it back a little bit? Okay. I don't know whether that's going to do anything better. It's much better. Leave it to Phil. Okay, I'm not trying to go away from you. When I look at myself as a man, I cannot see my face, and I have all that bright light. Okay, so we will have verses read as we go through that psalm, that poem. Our last study in the book of Job dates back to August 21st, about a month. And since then, we had holidays, and I was gone, and obligations for the ministry, all that kept us away from the study. But, I was going to tell you a secret. The secret is that I don't know yet what I want to do on Sunday evening after Job. I've had a wonderful time with Ecclesiastes. We had Job. And I'm taking suggestions, okay? So you can pass. I've been praying about it, and nothing seems to come what I want to do on Sunday evening after that. So maybe I'll do some psalms, or I don't know. So pray with me, because we pretty much after tonight have one lesson, so I have to figure out pretty quickly. Thank God we have the a conference in October, so I could find ways to, gain some time there. But by November, I have to have something. So pray with me that Lord will guide us on what we should study next. Okay. So we return tonight and to the study of Job. And when we left off, we were studying the poem in Job 28. And the study of Job 28 must be, as I said then, it must be approaching two ways. One, the context of it, which we studied in August 28, and the content Job 28, which we hope to study this evening. And the context was more academic, and I remember I was looking at the YouTube presentation when I was saying this, say, bear with me, we have to go through this to validate scripture. Well, that's behind us, but I'm going to do a little bit of review for you to catch up. So on August 21st, we studied the context of the poem, and there are three main problems associated with the poem that we attempted to solve in our last lesson. So the first problem is who is speaking? There are three cycles of speeches between each of the three friends and Job. So in the first cycle, going from chapter 4 to chapter 14, each of the three friends spoke. And after each spoke, Job answered. So we have six speeches, one by each friend, and Job's responses to each one, that's six. The same thing happened in the second cycle of speeches, chapter 15 to 21. The speeches were shorter, but in those chapters, each one of them spoke and Job responded, and we had six. But when we get to the third cycle, chapter 22 to 27, the first two friends spoke, Job answers to each one of them, that's four. But the last one, Zophar, who generally spoke last, was not introduced. In every one of those speeches, the narrator made sure that so-and-so is speaking, so-and-so is speaking, Job is responding, so-and-so speaks, but we don't have that. after. And then the speech of Zophar was unusually short. And then we have chapter 28. And chapter 28 is not introduced as being the speech of anybody. So the first contextual problem with chapter 28 is the incomplete third cycle of speeches. Who is speaking? The second problem in the context of chapter 28 is that the style is different from the style of any of the speakers in the book. You look at, I preach here and you know my style. Okay, well, I was going to say that you don't need to see that I'm present, but my accent will give it away anyhow. Okay, you know my style. And you can hear Pastor Joe Centermore, who preached last week. He has a deeper voice. That's stronger than mine. He is a Haitian. He speaks French. In fact, he used to teach French at the university level, I think, or high school. But you can see that's not my style. And when you look at those as Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, Job, Elihu, and even God, you can see chapter 28 does not resemble to the style of any one of them. So who wrote that? And the third problem in the context of chapter 28 is that the content of the poem seems contrary to the sentiments of Job and of any of the three friends, for that matter. When you see how those people spoke, what they said, that's not what they were talking about. What we have in that chapter, they said, I have wisdom, or as Dr. Fauci used to say, I am wisdom. You know, I am science, he said. And everyone thought they had it. Job thought he had it. The three friends thought he had it. Elihu thought he had it. And God said, none of you knows what you are talking about, when God started talking. So when you come to that chapter 28, you are asking, it's not their style, nobody's introduced, and who is speaking? So to those three problems, in response, we have three proposed solutions that we discussed. The first one proposed solution is that some believe that the poem is added by an intruder. Okay? The problem is it's added by an intruder. And to that, I went through a lot of things to show that it cannot be. The second solution was that others believe that the poem of chapter 28 is authentic, but that's not where it should be placed. So they decide, no, when I look at it, I would put it this way, and I think that it is misplaced. And we responded to that to say that we cannot go and dissect scripture and decide where we want to put things. The third solution, that is the one that I also agree to and I propose, is that the poem of chapter 28 is authentic and it is placed where it's supposed to be placed. So you ask me, okay, well, does that solve the problem? Well, we argued that this poem is written by the narrator. He is the only one who speaks in third person. He is the only one in the book who is not introduced. Everybody else is always introduced when they are speaking. And this is the only place where you see this poetic part that is in. We have to see that it is the narrator. So we prove that portion, and we conclude that the chapter was written by him, and it is the climax of the book, actually. It is the message of the book. It is that wisdom is the key to navigating the troubled waters of suffering. But where can that wisdom be found? Where is it? Everybody suffers, but not everybody has wisdom. And even those who have wisdom, very often they don't have enough in order to face the suffering they go through. So the prescription of the narrator is this chapter 28. And studying the content of the poem, in addition to the context that we have studied a month ago, will certainly show the value of that poem in the book. And that is what we endeavor to do this evening, studying the content of the poem on wisdom. I have a microphone back there, and it's going to work its way through anybody who wishes or to read, who accepts to read, so we'll pass it until we finish the chapter. So we will read as we go along. It is reported that the French philosopher Voltaire considered this poem of Job 28 as the most beautiful poem ever written. And when you study this beautiful poem in the context of the book of Job, you must somewhat agree to his evaluation. Both in form and in content, this poem is strikingly beautiful. And as I'm going to try to expound on it this evening, I feel that my own study spoils the beauty and value of the poem. I wish God himself, would, the Lord Jesus Christ, or the narrator who wrote this, would come and tell us about it. And my study cannot do justice to the beauty of this poem, but we'll try. Verses 12 and 20 of the poem tell us what the narrator wants us to seek in the poem, what he intends to answer through the poem. And any outline or explanation of the poem that does not emphasize the intent of the narrator must be off base. This is the issue that the narrator raises. In verse 12, he asks this question, but where can wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? He speaks again to try to answer that question, putting himself somewhat in the position of Job and the three friends and human beings in general. He comes back to it in verse 20 to say that everything we can bring up, we cannot find wisdom there. And he says in verse 20, so from where then does wisdom come? If we come, we'll go through the most sophisticated things that human beings do on earth, the most precious things that human beings can have to acquire whatever they want, those cannot produce wisdom. This is a desperate state in which human beings are. They need wisdom to navigate the most troubled waters of their lives, but whatever they can do, whatever they can put before it, they cannot find it. So from where then does wisdom come, and where is the place of understanding? And in the end, he will tell us. The three friends of Job spoke. Job responded. Every one of them tries to make sense of this most complex and most perplexing issue that is called suffering. Suffering, that is, in the life of the most righteous man on earth. That's even more complicated. And who can comprehend this kind of thing? If this best of men on earth have not been able to demonstrate wisdom, if wisdom is not found in the best of people on earth, where then can it be found? And that is the question that unlocks the whole book. Wherever you can find the source of wisdom, there you will also find the wisdom that this source has demonstrated in managing something as complex as the suffering of a righteous person. It takes quite some wisdom to bring some such calamities in the life of the best man on earth and not make mistake about it. To navigate it, plan it, manage it, everything, plan in advance, to culminate to an end that nobody could have fathomed. So this poem, therefore, has two main parts to it. Verse 21 to 22, it's the source of wisdom. And verses 23 to 28, the wisdom of the source. And these are the two parts that we will study together this evening. And we'll begin with the first one, the source of wisdom. And there are three parts to that source of wisdom, verses 1 to 12, verses 13 to 20, and verses 21 to 22. The first part of this, verses 1 to 22 to 12, speaks about the human inadequacy to finding the source of wisdom. Even the best that men does, I mean, you are talking about things that make you say, wow, look at what he does. And you put that for men to find wisdom, that itself is still inadequate. It's still insufficient. The best achievements and skills of man in extracting the most complicated things from the earth are still inadequate to find wisdom, let alone extracting that wisdom. You cannot even find it, let alone being able to take it if it were to be found. And these 12 verses have really three stanzas in them, each one having four verses. Stanzas 1 goes from verse 1 to 4, stanza 2, verses 5 to 8, and stanza 3, 9 to 12. And so we are going to study those 12 verses under the guise of those three stanzas, beginning with the first one. In that first stanza, verses 1 to 4, the narrator talks about metal extraction from inside the earth. You talk about something that is very complicated. At that age, with no John Deere, no Kubota, I mean, it was quite some work to do that, and that marvels people that at that time they were able to not only find in the depth of the earth those metals, but also to extract them. The first thing he talks about, and we're going to read those two verses, is the location of important metals in verses 1 and 2. And let's read those verses and you will see.
Surely there is a mine for silver and a place where they refine gold. Iron is taken from the dust and copper is smelted from rock.
So you are talking about precious metals that are important to people. They know where to find them. I mean, you are walking on this earth and somehow someone knows that way down here, without none of the instruments we have today, that silver, fine gold, iron, bronze can be found inside the earth in that place. You would think someone who has that kind of skill would be able to find wisdom as well, wouldn't you? And what about the exploration? The exploration after important metals in verse 3. I mean, the kind of exploration they go into. Look at verse 3.
Man puts an end to darkness and searches every recess for ore in the darkness and by shadow of death.
You are talking about terrible conditions to explore and find, and yet man is able to do that. I mean, it's mind-boggling what they are able to do. What about the skills they have to extract metal from the earth? Verse 4.
He breaks open a shaft away from people in places forgotten by feet. They hang far away from men. They swing to and fro.
I mean, you are looking at this. How did they think about that method? I mean, those are very smart people to be able to do that kind of thing. So the inference that we have in the first four verses, that first stanza, is that people can find the location of such important metals. They can engage in exploring dangerous and remote places to find them. And they have rare and sophisticated skills to find them. You would think these abilities would be adequate to find wisdom. He's still keeping that suspense to tell us in verse 12 that it's still insufficient, still inadequate. And he continues in the second stanza telling you about all the marvelous things that men are able to find. Stanzas 5, the second stanza, verses 5 to 8, he talks about, in verses 1 to 4, he talks about metal extraction inside the earth. Now he talks about metal extraction on the earth, verses 5 to 8. And in the first, in verses 5 to 6, he talks again, he comes back to this idea of location for precious metals. Look at those verses, please, 5 and 6.
As for the earth, from it comes bread, but underneath it turned up as fire. Its stones are source of sapphires, and it contains gold dust.
So you are talking about very common things that men do. the surface of the earth, the first 6-7 inches, okay, that produces food. I mean, imagine, that's extraordinary. Someone has said civilization means 6 to 7 inches of dirt. And farmers do know, without those 6 to 7 inches, there is nobody that's going to be on the earth. So he's talking about this, the common thing that makes men survive, and men find a way to take 6 to 7 inches of dirt and make civilization happen. And he says, right there on the face of the earth, you just turn it around and you find, you disturb the surface of it, and you of the earth, you find sapphire and gold. I mean, you can find, men can do that. And he says, look at the skill the men put to find the metals in verses 7 and 8.
No bird of prey knows that hidden path, no falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it, and no lion prowls there.
So what man is able to do to find those precious metals on the earth, even the greatest predators cannot fulfill that kind of feat. You talk about an eagle who can see things from very, very far and go directly, boom! And you talk, that's in the air. And you thought about the lion, which is at the top of the food chain. They said the things that men can do to find those measures, that kind of skill even surpasses the greatest predators. So the inference is the same. People develop the greatest skills to extract precious metals, skills of extracting that the most sophisticated animals do not have. But be it in the air like birds of prey or on the earth like lion, the skills of men to do this thing cannot match what those animals do to hunt. And the skills those animals have cannot match what man has as skill to find metals on the earth. You would think that these sophisticated abilities would be adequate enough for men to find wisdom. Still no. And now in the third stanza, you have first stanza, extracting metals inside the earth. Second stanza, extracting metals on the earth. And now, man is going to go to the heights and still do extraordinary things. I mean, you talk about, wow, the wonders what men think. And that stanza, verses 9 to 12, and we're going to read one verse at a time. You will find those kind of things that men do. Verse 9, disturbing mighty mountains to reach precious metals. Look at this. Listen to this. What men do. Verse 9.
Man's hand assaults the flinty rock and lays bare the roots of the mountains.
Man, I'm telling you. I mean, you think you'll be afraid of a mountain? Man is not. I mean, they can go to that mountain and blast rocks, even if it's made of granite. They need that precious metal. They are going to break that granite and get it. Verse 10.
He cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing.
I mean, if one man wants to go to the depth, okay, in verse 10, I mean, there is nothing that's going to prevent man from finding a way for his eyes to see what's hidden in the depth. Look at verse 11. Deterring mighty rivers.
He dams up the streams from flowing, and what is hidden he brings out to the light.
I mean, if they have to build dams, if they have to deter rivers, they find a way to do it. I mean, mountains, death, rivers. You would think that we have so much skills and abilities, sophisticated ways, that somehow men will find a way to get where wisdom is, locate it, and extract it. Verse 12.
But where can wisdom be found, and where is the place of understanding?
So you see how beautiful the poem is put together? Despite all of these sophisticated skills and these great achievements, man is not able to even locate wisdom, let alone if they were to find it, to extract it from its location. As precious as we know wisdom to be, and as needed as it is to man, it was just proven through the speeches of the wisest men on earth that even they lacked wisdom to comprehend this common plague among mankind, which is called suffering, especially the suffering of the righteous. And I will tell you, friends, God has endowed human beings with a lot of skills and abilities. I mean, it is amazing what human beings do. Very sophisticated skills that help human beings accomplish marvelous and wonderful projects. I personally love to watch these marvelous things on the History Channel or National Geographic or Discovery. I mean, I look at this, man, I wish I could do that. The engineering of things, even how food is made. I mean, I watch how Hershey discovered how to make those kisses that he makes. I mean, it was not a small thing. You look at human beings, what they do, cars, airplanes. I remember my history professor in college, and he was talking about his dad, his father, who would go and watch the airport. You know, he'll sit and watch a whole day those airplanes and will shake his head. He said, I still don't understand how that mass of metal can fly. We're accustomed to it. But, I mean, that's quite something. And not only that, man, what marveled me when I used to fly a lot around the world was how still that thing was at 700 miles an hour. It's as if it's sitting there, and I have my water right there on that plate, and it's not even shaking. I mean, that's extraordinary. They go to the moon. They make computers, bridges, dams, space stations, steak. I mean, that's extraordinary what human beings can do. You know, ice cream? Ooh, I mean, I'm telling you. And however great and sophisticated are these skills, the psalmist says, the narrator is saying, they are still inadequate. In and of themselves, they are inadequate to lead human beings to the fear of God. The wisdom that comes from above cannot be reached through skills that explore the depths of the earth, the surface of the earth, the heights of the earth. They can't. And if men cannot locate wisdom to extract it, despite men's extraordinary skills and abilities, what if men were to investigate by asking others to produce it for them? What if they had enough power to just go ahead and buy it? If you are not able to produce something yourself, something that you desperately need, what do you generally do? You try to purchase it from someone else, right? And verses 13 to 20 show the incapacity of mankind to acquire wisdom through trade. Verses 13 to 20 tell us that human beings have the incapacity to find the source of wisdom. Wisdom is inaccessible to human beings, even if they were to open up all the wallets of the earth combined. No wealthy person can extend his or her life to perpetuity. Jeff Bezos, who used to be, until he got divorced, he used to be the richest man on earth, he cannot extend his life by 1 second with his money. Likewise, no wealthy person can acquire wisdom through the power of their purse. And in those 8 verses, those are the 8 statements that are being done. And in each one, they tell you, wisdom is so this, that even the extreme on this cannot get it. Wisdom is so this, that the extreme there cannot get it. In verse 13, he's telling that wisdom is so otherworldly that it is priceless. You cannot put a price on it. Can someone read that for us, please?
Man knoweth not its price, neither is it found in the land of the living.
No one can appraise wisdom in market comparison. When you are valuing your house, now I don't even ask them all the time. They are sending me this. Your house is worth this, and in comparison to all those other things. There is nothing to compare it to put a price on it. It is, wisdom is so otherworldly that it is priceless. Look at verse 14 now.
The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me.
Wisdom is so rare that even the secret and black market of the abyss and of the deep ocean sea cannot find it to sell it to you. I mean, you are talking about places where anything you want, you can find. That's where everything ends. It's like the dump of everything. You could go there and say, Can I find something there that maybe someone left? I could reuse it? Or do you have something in your antique there that I can find? No, you will not find wisdom. It's so rare. Verse 15, it is also very precious.
It cannot be purchased for gold, nor can silver be weighed for its price.
Wisdom is so precious that we cannot force someone to generate it, even when we offered pure gold and pure silver in exchange. You go to that person and say, I'll give you all the wisdom. I mean, you know, even if you were to give me, isn't that what the so-called wise man told Nebuchadnezzar? He says, what you're asking is impossible. It is impossible. No king has ever been, you know, so unreasonable to ask someone like this. It's impossible. Even if you were to give us everything, I can't do it. And that's what also Balaam told Balak. I mean, you could give me all kinds of money. What you're asking me, I cannot do it. It's not in me. And that is what that verse is telling us. It's so precious that there is no way that you can force someone to produce it for you with whatever you will give in exchange. Verse 16. Wisdom is so unique.
It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir or in precious onyx or sapphire.
That wisdom is so unique that most exemplary commodities such as common gold or crystal or metals or jewelry and pure gold, that none of them will be in its class. It is in a class by itself. And you put those things and you try to put it, say, no. They are not in the same category, the same class. Verse 18, look at how valuable wisdom is.
Coral and crystal are not to be mentioned, and the acquisition of wisdom is above that of pearls.
Yes, yes. It is so valuable that the most valuable commodities could not equal its value. And look at verse 19. Wisdom is so itself that nothing of the most precious metals on earth, be it the topaz from Ethiopia or fine gold or any other you may mention, none of them can be evoked to portray what we are talking about when we are talking about wisdom. Listen to that, verse 19.
The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold.
I mean, there is nothing. There is nothing you could say that, you know, this is what I'm talking about. When you are talking about wisdom, you have nothing to compare it to. And then we get to verse 20, same thing as verse 12. And he says this to us, please.
So where does wisdom come from? Where is the source of understanding?
Human beings are incapable of finding wisdom through their usual transactions. You cannot pay money to get it from schools. You cannot get it in the marketplace. You cannot get it in the bank. You cannot get it regardless your purchasing power. You cannot get it anywhere because it cannot be found anywhere among the realm of human beings. It is rare. It is precious. It is unique. This wisdom is exotic. It is valuable. It is in a class all by itself. You can feel the desperation building up in this poem. I mean, you look at it, it seems that there is no hope for Job and the three friends. There is no hope for humanity. The best of human beings cannot produce wisdom. The richest of human beings cannot acquire wisdom in exchange. Therefore, where and how can wisdom be found? Could someone be smart enough to invent it? Verses 21 to 22 will try to tell you that many human beings can try, but to no avail. So verses 21 and 22, the last part of that passage is saying that talking about human ignorance in finding the source of wisdom. Creation is evidence of wisdom, but creation cannot produce wisdom. It's a proof. It is wisdom that brought it into being. He will tell you, well, I've heard of it because look at me. I exist because of that. But if you tell me how to produce it to you, I can't. And in each of those, there are four parts in two verses, and each line is telling us something about the ignorance of the whole creation on how to produce wisdom. Let's read those two in verse 21, please.
Thus it is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the sky.
Wisdom, first part of verse 21, does not come from among men living on the surface of the earth. Nor does wisdom come from the sky where birds fly. Nor does wisdom come from under the earth or the depth where human beings cannot reach, verse 22. Nor does wisdom come from any of those places. Can we read verse 22?
Abaddon and death say, with our ears we have heard a report of it.
Yeah, wisdom is evident even in the uttermost parts of creation. That's why they can say, yeah, I know it exists. I've heard of it. All can testify that their existence is out of wisdom. None can produce it, nor give it. They just see it as evidence for people to talk about. Was that verse 22 you just read? Okay. So, as in the whole story of Job, the narrator is the one who tells us what is going on. Without the narrator, we would be completely in the dark. We will not know why the calamities that fell Job happened. Without the narrator, we will not know how it all ended. And without the narrator, we will not have something to unlock the whole perplexity of Job and his friends. The speeches of the friends of Job and of Job himself asked the wrong questions, and therefore they provided the wrong answers. God's speeches brought out the limitations of Job and the sovereignty of God. It doesn't tell you about the specific thing that is wisdom. He just told Job, you didn't have it. And I have this thing. In verses 23 to 28, the narrator echoes God's speeches. Wisdom to decipher the most complex and the most perplexing issues on earth. That wisdom is not about a thing. It's not a concept. It's not something that you can go get somewhere and purchase it or explore and extract it. That wisdom is about the who. It's not about the what. That wisdom is about relationship. It's not about acquisition. Hence, the narrator tells us about wisdom. In verses 23 to 28, it is from and by God above. You get this by unifying with God above. It is not something that he can hand to you, detach from him, that you can get and, I got it. You cannot do like Simon and say, man, look at those, have the power of the Holy Spirit. I'm going to give you money to get it. Peter said, may perish with you because you think that the power of God can be purchased with money. No, you don't get that. You get the Holy Spirit through relationship with Jesus Christ. And he dwells in you. It's a relationship. So we come to the second part of the poem, the wisdom of the source. When we look at the source of everything, we find in him what we call wisdom. It is not a concept. It is God who is who he is. The who that God is. The who that God is wisdom. And we must comply with him. There are three parts to those six verses, and each two verses is one part. The first part in verses 23 to 24, he's saying that, let me tell you about God's wisdom. He sees everything. Let's read those verses each time together, verses 23 and 24.
God understands its way, and he knows its place, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens.
I mean, there are three things that he is telling us there, two in verse 23 and one in verse 24. The first part of verse 23, the narrator said, only God understands. Only God understands the route through the labyrinth that leads to wisdom. This twisted route, like a ball of messed yarn. It's so messed up, you don't know which one goes into the other. And he says, God knows exactly where every one of them in that big mess circuit goes, how they begin and how they connect. God understands how all the circuits are connected to reach wisdom. He knows. And in the second part, he said, only God knows. Only God knows the fountain of wisdom, since it is in himself. I mean, he knows inside what it is in himself. And the third thing he says in verse 24, only God comprehends the whole intricate systems on how everything that exists functions and interconnects, as if it were looking at one simple picture before him. From beginning to end, they span everything, all the whole gears of everything from beginning to end. He knows how they interconnect, what happens before, and how what's going to happen after. That is in him. He cannot just take it and give it apart from him. So wisdom is in God, since only he can see everything, how they connect with each other, where they come from, where they are going, and how they are relating to each other in all their gears that work together. God sees everything. And everything that exists, whether visible or invisible, God also did it. God did everything, verses 21 and 26 tells us. Let's read those verses.
25 and 26,
excuse me.
When he imparted weight to the wind and meted out the waters by measure, when he set a limit for the rain and a course for the thunderbolt.
These two verses presage God's speeches in chapter 38 through 40, through 41, or 42, 41. So God's speeches were about they were about the origin of the universe and the operation of the universe. And we saw that he talks about the big things, the macrocosmic aspect, the big systems. And he talked about the details, the microcosmic aspect. Pretty much, that's what these two verses are saying. It's almost like this is the passage from which God preached his sermons later on. So these verses constitute the figure of speech we call synecdoche. So a synecdoche, that is when you say the parts to signify the whole. Those three or four examples that the narrator gives us, they are examples to give you a picture of the fact that God does everything. He did everything, everything, everything you can, the most complex thing. This is what wisdom does, okay? And the elements could not have been imagined by human beings in building up a universe system. I mean, there are certain things you are thinking about. Would you have imagined that a nose has to be here and two eyes? I mean, even when they are doing Star Wars people, do you see how ugly they make those people? I mean, human beings cannot make someone as beautiful as my wife. They cannot imagine it. It had to be made by God. You know, that's how she married me. I said, God made you, you know, beautiful and so on. You know, and so they are impressive, the things that God does. I mean, impressive, powerful, ubiquitous, consistent, unattainable, and immutable. The kinds of things God does, just thinking it. And I put this before you. There is no way that a human being can think of something that does not exist. You cannot think outside of existence. God thinks it. All the things that they call science fiction, they are pretty much interconnection of things that already exist. But God thinks of those things and he just let it be. Nobody was thinking what, when he said let it be, all that was right there. I don't know, when I say right there, that's a human way of speaking. So look at those verses. Did you already read them? Okay, so there are things. God purposes everything. As example, he determined the weight of the wind. Think about this. You see the kind of things, the way he puts it? Can you weight the wind? I mean, God knows things that people cannot even, he does things that people cannot even think about. God calibrates everything. He appointed the waters by measure. He knows exactly how many ounces that is needed there and so on, this and there, to make that system he created function. God regulates everything. He made the law for the rain. There is not one time when the rain is going to say, you know, I'm tired of being rain, I'm going to be rock. No, impossible. God plans everything. He prepared the path that any and every thunderbolt should take. You see how he's telling you this? He's telling you that when you see the lightnings going in all those paths, none of those paths is a surprise to God. When you are saying someone could be struck by lightning perchance, nothing of the lightnings is perchance for God. He knows exactly what degree of turn, what curve, when, and exactly what's going to happen with every one of them. Wouldn't you call that wisdom? Do you think that such wisdom could be hit and miss in your life? If God can calculate it, prepared in advance, exactly the path of the lightning, do you think the things happening in the lives of children of God will be kind of a hit and miss? A hazard? Wouldn't you believe that God has calculated that? He knows what he's doing? Do you think that such wisdom would operate through trial and error? Let me put Hans Bernard in this situation to see what happened. It's just an experiment, Hans. You know, no problem. Job, I'm just trying something here. You think that's what happened? No. He purposes everything. He calibrates everything. He regulates everything. He plans everything. And that is not even all. He does not depend on anybody else to receive commands and direction to do the things that he does. God decides everything as well, as verses 27 and 28 tells us. Let's read those verses. Now everybody is afraid to read. Okay, let's go. 27 and 28. Those are the last verses. My time is pretty much up.
Then he saw it and declared it. He established it and also watched it out, searched it out.
And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. Mm-hmm. And to depart from evil is understanding.
The narrator knew I was going to preach what I preached this morning. There are three things here saying, two in verse 27 and one in verse 28. The first part of verse 27 is that by contrast to human beings, where wisdom is inaccessible to human beings, guess what? God accesses wisdom whenever he needs to use it. It's right there in him. Oh, I need wisdom to do this. Bam. He doesn't need to go explore and find it somewhere else. Try to buy it. Try to extract it. No, it's right here in him. That's where it resides. And he uses it whenever he needs to use it. In fact, there is nothing that God does without wisdom. And the second part of the verse, it tells us, by contrast, human beings, God made wisdom what wisdom is. It's not something he has to get outside of himself. And that is the foundation of all theology. Justice, for example, is not something that exists on its own and that God has to abide by. No. Justice is justice because God is just. Love is love because God is love. Sanctification is sanctification because God is sanctification. Life is life because God is life. It's not something that somehow that is outside of God that God has to abide by. Wisdom is wisdom because God is wisdom. God made wisdom to be what wisdom is. And in verse 28, he says, let me tell you how you human beings, you access wisdom. Not by exploration, not by purchase, not by trying to be smart. By contrast to human beings, God prescribes wisdom. Fear God and do all his commandments. It's profitable for all wisdom that you can imagine. That's what verse 28 says. Wisdom is godliness. Godliness is the manifestation of wisdom. Fear God and do all his commandments. You do not need to explore for it in the earth, on the earth, or above the earth. You cannot buy it regardless your wealth. Fear God and everything else will fall into place. And as we preach this morning, and this is a limitless profit available to human beings on earth. Limitless. You devote yourself to godliness and then somehow everything falls into place. Maybe not immediately. Maybe God can leave you in suspense for a little while. But godly people don't go astray. Godliness is profitable to all things. There is a sphere of life and a sense of God's direction. There is a confidence of acting beyond a shadow of a doubt. There is a touch of the miraculous that only godliness can generate. The narrator is telling us that this is the same message of Job. Godliness. That's where Job started. Remember? This is the most godly person. And then suffering came and disturbed that. And guess where he ended? He said, well, I had it at the beginning. Why did I give myself all that trouble? That's why he confessed to God. He said, man, I was dumb. I am insignificant and I'm ignorant. God didn't give any explanation. He was satisfied because he realized God, fearing God is all that matters, even when he doesn't have the answers for himself. When God spoke his two speeches, God realized that his understanding of suffering was not something to acquire. Understanding what's happening, that's not the important thing. It doesn't solve anything. The question of why? Why does the righteous suffer? What are you going to do with it if you know why? Job realized he wasn't significant and he just returned to where he started. fear God. That's what the narrator said. There was no one like him who feared God and hated evil. No one like him. And guess what the narrator tells us? Job had it right. And I can tell you, if you are going through hard times and you are a child of God, I cannot explain to you why things happen to you in your lives. I have no idea, and you have no idea. Even if we did, unfortunately, you are not going to be able to solve that problem. But all I can tell you, the Lord is gracious. He's compassionate. He's not making a mistake. He knows exactly the contour of the lightnings that are going through your life. He knows. He is sovereign, and he is sovereignly wise. He is sovereign, and he is sovereignly gracious. He is sovereignly good. And just put your trust in him. Keep on trusting him. He knows everything. He does everything. And he decides everything. All for his own glory and our own good. Let us pray. Father, we thank you. We thank you for this. I do not have a human answer to the human suffering of people in my assembly whom I love. And sometimes I think of some of them knowing what either they go through or some loved one goes through. And sometimes with tears in my eyes, feeling so incapable, wanting to find something to comfort, to satisfy their quest if they have one. I have known. And the narrator tells us that as we read the book of Job, that the answers to what we go through in life are not intellectual answers. They are not material answers. They are not human answers. In fact, they are not even answers at all. They are relationships. Your children are yours, and you decide, some through the waters, some through the fire. But you have decided that all of them are going to go through the blood. In your kindness and graciousness, I pray, Father, that you will sustain every one of my brothers and sisters, that in their relationship with you, that their fear of God will never be in question because of the complexities and perplexities of things they go through on earth. I pray in this church that godliness will prevail, that from children to old, I myself could look at their lives and learn, because it's a limitless thing, and it's not that the pastor himself has to be the number one or can be the number one. As some of my brothers and sisters, I look at them and their love for the Lord, their dedication and their faith and faithfulness. They are models and inspiration to me. And as we are on this journey, Lord, you decide the contours of the lives of every one of your children. Nothing takes you by surprise. And I pray, Father, that you will sustain them in their inner person and in every step that they take, that your goodness and mercy will never lack, that your greatness will manifest itself in them and for them, that your love will be their portion in every part of their lives, that they would not falter, they would not quit, they would not revolt, but that they would be the testimony for Christ in everything. Magnify yourself and make of us here at Robinson Baptist Church people who, by relationship with God, never lack wisdom in the complexities and perplexities of life. We commit ourselves to you. I commit my flock to you, the people whom I love and pray for, the people I think about all the time and I cry for and I preach to, and I try to guide in relationship with the Lord for the best relationship possible they could have. I pray for them that will keep them in perfect peace with their hearts centered upon you and you alone. In Jesus Christ's name I pray. Amen.